You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko shimena kitoku ingoa, no mai haere mai ki te wire mo tēnei rā. Hello, welcome to The Wire. Today is Wednesday, the 19th of April. I'm Shimena. I'll be with you for the next hour. Also, my producer, Adam, is joining me here in the studio, and he will take over in the second part of the show. Coming up today, we speak with a nurses' organisation representative about the monumental pay increase for aged care workers that was announced yesterday. We look at Turkey's referendum in the weekend, which resulted in the decision that the president would get sweeping new powers. We talk about the significance of the move and what it means for the future of Turkey. AUT's Alan Blackman joins us for Dear Science. This week we'll be talking through some commonly touted scientific myths, namely that water fluoridation is toxic and that alternative medicine is a thing. We'll also be talking to Alan about a recent Netflix series that has prompted controversy around its treatment of suicide. And the People's Mental Health Review is launching later this afternoon. I speak with Marianne Elliott from Action Station for a preview of what we can expect to come out of the report. And scientists will be marching globally this Saturday. We spoke to one of the New Zealand organisers as to why this is happening. If you want to let us know about any of your thoughts, anything that comes to mind when you hear any of the things that we cover today, please give us a call or a text. 309 3879 is the number to call, or 5395 on the text machine. Let's get into it.
Can anyone explain why the modern day whales are so big?
The Wire.
First up, my producer Adam will introduce his story.
A monumental equal pay settlement has been achieved, giving aged care workers a well-deserved pay rise of 42% over the next 4 years. The proposed settlement comes after findings of gender bias were discovered within the industry. I spoke with Industrial Services Manager of the New Zealand Nurses Organisation, C. Payne, about why this is not only a substantial achievement for the industry, but also for gender equality in pay.
We're very excited by the settlement. It has been an issue that we've been campaigning on for nearly 20 years, and I think it finally allows women who are doing care and support work to balance the pay ledger in this country and have the real true value of their work and skills acknowledged through a decent pay system.
Has it been a hard-fought battle to achieve this?
It's been an incredibly long battle. We've had, over the years, we've had many campaigns, Fair Share for Aged Care, a wide range of approaches from various governments we've taken forward, all to no avail. And I think in the end, the legal approach and the foresight and determination of members to keep fighting for equal pay against all the odds, really, has been tremendous and has resulted in this win.
So this is not only a victory for care workers, but it's also a victory for gender equality, am I right?
There has been another piece of work going on at the same time as the equal pay case for Christine Bartlett, and that was some work that the government, off the back of the first decision, set up an equal pay principles working group. And the equal pay principles working group is working with the government to draft a new Equal Pay Act that reflects the court's decision in the Christine Bartlett case. That will give women in historically female-dominated industries the opportunity to raise equal pay claims and, like care and support workers, have their work valued through a process of negotiation and reaching settlements, as we have done with the care and support workers.
Have we got any indication as to when this new bill may be passed?
We understand that it's being drafted now and it's nearly there, and I think there was a clear signal from the government that it would be introduced in the following year, so post-election.
Okay. Obviously the monetary benefits to care workers is great, but what additional benefits will we see through this pay rise?
I think it will just give the impetus to other groups of women who are working in historically female-dominated work. It gives them the impetus to actually set up bargaining processes. Already there are a number of those underway, and the State Services Commission is working in the state sector with both support workers in education, in early childhood education, and also there is the midwife conversation that happened off the back of that too, where there is a process around negotiation process being put around it. So I think what it is driving is a process of negotiation rather than a process of litigation from here on. And I think when we have the new Act, that will give us an opportunity to assess where unions represent members that are in those historically female-dominated industries, there's a chance to assess how the settlement impacts on our members. For nursing, we will be doing an assessment. NZNO supports 100% equal pay equity for women and for nursing, and that's across the whole range of nursing. And whilst there's been some adjustment, we will be taking the approach of considered assessment. And it's a complex issue. We need a well-considered approach. And our members don't just, they're not generic. They work in different sectors, and those different sectors already have pay inequalities that still need to be addressed.
The Wire. That was Industrial Services Manager of the New Zealand Nurses Organisation, C. Payne. In a referendum in the weekend, Turkey chose to grant President Recep Tayyip Erdogan sweeping new powers. The country's long-standing parliamentary system has been abolished in favour of an executive presidency, which will merge the roles of the president and the prime minister and could potentially keep Erdogan in office until 2029. This morning, I spoke to Stephen Hoadley from the University of Auckland's Political Studies Department about the significance and meaning of the move.
Well, it means that the power will be centralized in Turkey to a much greater extent than before. It has been, of course, previously run by the Ottoman Empire and very centralized power system. So in some respects, Turkey is going back to its historical roots. For those of us in democratic countries in the West, this is dismaying. We feel that power should be more dispersed, pluralism and open government should be the rule. And so we feel that somehow Turkey is moving backwards.
And so what new powers does Erdogan have?
Well, he at the moment he has powers as prime minister. There is a titular president, much like the monarch in Great Britain, for example. The real power rests in the hands of the prime minister, who is Erdogan. But in, I think, 2019, when the new system comes fully into place, he will have enormous powers. He can appoint top public officials. He can appoint his vice presidents. He can intervene in the judiciary and appoint the chief justices. He can impose a state of emergency and then issue laws by decree rather than going through the parliament or through the assembly. So we feel that although these are all the powers that the U.S. president has, but they're much more benign because the U.S. president is checked very strongly by a Congress that cannot be dismissed and a judiciary that has on many occasions ruled presidential decisions unconstitutional. So that Turkey has all the features of the American system, but it's all the bad features and not all the good ones as well.
And so critics of the move are saying it turns Erdogan into essentially a dictator. Is this an overreaction?
It's hard to avoid strong words like dictator. Certainly authoritarian is the word we use in political studies, that something in between democracy and totalitarianism. So he will definitely be an authoritarian leader with great powers. He's already exercised them as prime minister. He's imprisoned 10,000 people. He has dismissed enormous numbers of journalists, teachers, military officers, and so forth as a result of the attempted coup last year. So, and he's curbed the press. There's very few newspapers or opposition parties that dare speak out. There are a few, and they're reported in the Western press. But Erdogan regards the West as misguided, and he's called the West a crusader mentality. Now, that's pretty extraordinary because they use the word crusader, means he's invoking the Crusades, meaning the attack by the Christians on the Muslim world in the Middle East. Now, that's a very inflammatory characterization of legitimate Western criticism of his extraordinary powers.
Mm. I mean, it's been a rough time politically, I mean, for Turkey in recent years, though. I mean, for one, as you mentioned, the failed coup last year. Do you think supporters see the change as bringing, I mean, more stability to Turkey?
Oh, yes, his supporters are in favor of it. 51% voted yes for the new constitution. They celebrate stability. They like the idea that a strong leader will restore not only financial growth, but also curb the Kurds. A fifth of the population are Kurdish, not Turkish, and some of those Kurds are in open revolt through the PKK, the Kurdish, what is called a terrorist organization. And this complicates the rule from Ankara. It's interesting that the vote went as follows. The three biggest cities in Turkey, including Istanbul, all voted no. These are liberal cities. These are more cosmopolitan areas. The voters, 49% of them, said, no, we don't want more powers in Erdogan's hands. It was the rural areas that voted yes by 51%. So it illustrates the split in Turkey between the more liberal cities and the more conservative countryside. The cities are more secular, the countryside is more Islamic, and then, of course, there's the complicating factor of the Kurds. Naturally, the Kurds would all vote no because they don't want greater powers to suppress their legitimate aspirations for some sort of autonomy and recognition.
Mm. And so I guess this is very clear evidence of a fractured Turkey, right?
Very fractured. It's a worry. If we look at the foreign policy aspect, Turkey is an anchor point of the NATO alliance. The United States has a large Air Force facility in Turkey at Incirlik Air Force Base, from which they can launch attacks on the Syrian Islamic State. The NATO alliance is under some strain now, with differences on how to deal with Russia. There's some fear that the Turks and the Russians will make common cause, both of them skeptical of the liberal West of Western Europe and the United States, for example, and that this will create a shift in the balance of power. There's also the question of what happens in Syria. The Turks have moved their troops into Syria, ostensibly to fight the Islamic State, but in fact they're fighting the Kurds. The Kurds are very effective fighters. They're fighting the Islamic State. And Turkey is working at cross purposes with the Western alliance that is based in Baghdad, of which New Zealand is a part, and that the Turks are playing in some respects a spoiler role. They're diverting attention from the real issue, which is the Islamic State, and causing some confusion about what their purposes are. But nevertheless, they are one of the several outside powers now operating. They say they have a legitimate reason. They've got 3 million Syrian refugees have fled north from the fighting, and they're all now in Turkey. So the Turks say, look, we have a stake in this. We want peace. We want stability because, look, we're the largest refugee host in the world at this particular point in time. So the Turks do have a point of view that their southern border is vulnerable. The refugee flows, the various attacks, the terrorist attacks in Istanbul and Ankara themselves have galvanized the Turks and made them very concerned about their own physical security against terrorism.
And so you think that this change will impact Turkey's position internationally then?
Yes, it certainly will. One of Erdogan's policies is to reintroduce the death penalty. Now, when Turkey was negotiating with the European Union, the European Union said, look, to the Turks, if you have a democratic system with proper human rights and eliminate the death penalty, which, of course, is totally eliminated in the European Union, we can consider your membership. There are a number of other factors as well, but the Turks did reform. They did democratize. They did reduce the influence of Islam and the military on both sides of the political spectrum in the political system. And the European Union gave Turkey a pretty good rating in terms of fulfilling the democratic criteria that the Europeans think are important. Well, now Turkey is moving backwards, curbing the press, curbing opposition parties, their political prisoners, and of course the death penalty would make it impossible for the Europeans to accept Turkey as a member of the European Union. So the possibilities that there's a bit of a fracture there, and the Turks may look for allies and friends elsewhere outside of Europe, and Russia is one possibility. And it means that the possibility of a ever greater European Union is more impossible, less feasible than ever before.
So is this move Turkey becoming less and less secular?
Yes, Erdogan is the head of a party called the Justice and Development Party. He has introduced more Islamic practices, approving the use of headscarves, for example, and is moving the country much more strongly in an Islamic direction. He regards Turkey as the natural leader of the Islamic world. Well, there are a lot of natural leaders, so there's a lot of competition out there, but Turkey wants to be one of them, along with Iran and Saudi Arabia and Egypt. And so we do see a trend, a very strong trend, to Islamic observations, Islamic holidays, Islamic customs are coming back in at the official level. They've always been there at the unofficial level, particularly in the countryside. But this again reverses a trend that was begun by Kemal Atatürk, the founder of modern Turkey in 1922, who secularized the country. And in the West, Turkey was a poster child. Turkey was an example of how you can have Islam and democracy together. And this is what the West wants. Well, it looks like that maybe Islam and democracy in Turkey are not so compatible under Erdogan's interpretation. And this is a great disappointment, who saw in Turkey a shining example of how Western democracy could coexist with the Islamic world.
You're tuned into The Wire.
That was Stephen Hoadley from the University of Auckland speaking about the referendum in Turkey in the weekend. We'll be back with Dear Science after a break.
Grab another crate because Record Store Day at Real Groovy is bursting at the seams with goodness. Snap up your very own breakfast with The Clean, a limited edition mug, tea towel and plate set designed by The Clean band members to raise money for the New Zealand Music Foundation. Get your live music fix from X Features, Echo O's, Contenders, Oscar Dowling and Bad Corporation. Plus, there's exclusive Record Store Day vinyl deals, freebies, a turntable giveaway, food and coffee. Record Store Day 2017, Saturday, April 22nd. At Real Groovy Records, Queen Street.
Just going to the bathroom. Oh, that's better.
Good morning.
What the? I'm going Wheeze.
But I've got such a cool breakfast.
It's 5 a.m. This is my bathroom. Wheeze, honestly.
Sorry. Go back to bed. I'll wait.
Who is that?
A blooming breakfast host in the bathroom again. So impatient.
Just going to start coffee. Get up when you're ready.
95BFM Breakfast with Hannah. Keen as every weekday morning from 7 a.m. With big thanks to Orcon. Get broadband, fibre and all the other internet stuff at orcon.net.nz.
Science is interesting, and if you don't agree, you can f*** off.
Now we have AUT's Alan Blackman joining us in the studio for Dear Science. How are you today, Alan?
I'm very good.
That's
Thank you,
great. He's here with me and Adam. First up today, we're chatting about how the argument around water fluoridation has come back into the media over the past week. Can you talk us through what's been happening?
Yeah, well, the wonderful Michelle Dickinson, a.k.a. Nano Girl, took a fluoride campaigner to task over this campaigner's letter to the MP, and which basically blamed the MP's two miscarriages on fluoride, which is just really rather reprehensible.
Totally, yeah.
Definitely.
Yeah. And so this created a bit of a storm, certainly on Michelle's website anyway, and she wrote a very reasoned rebuttal to all of this, And this was obviously picked up by News Hub and publicised, etc., etc. And so it's basically got fluoride back into the media and the whole question of fluoride. And this has been going on for, years and years and years and years and years. And it does kind of rear its head every now and then, certainly with regional councils, the devolution of whether or not sort of local water supplies should be fluoridated. And that decision has in certain cases been devolved to city councils and the like. And I think sort of down Tauranga or somewhere.
I think it was Hamilton a while ago.
That's right. No, you're right. It was Hamilton, yeah. And the big question over whether they should fluoridate or not fluoridate and everything. And the major argument against this seems to be the fact, the quote-unquote fact, sorry, that fluoride is apparently bad for you. And this is promulgated through various so-called scientists in the so-called scientific literature. And the way that this sort of works probably bears some explanation, I guess, because often we find that people who are sort of actively opposed to anything scientific will quote the fact that their facts, their alternative facts, have been published in the scientific literature. And the way that the scientific literature works is that you basically submit, you write your paper, you write up your findings or whatever, you then submit it to a journal, the journal then sends it out to reviewers to basically referee your paper, find out whether you've done the experiments right, whether your conclusions are justified. They then send it back to the editor of the journal saying either yes, publish this, or yes, publish it, but make them make some changes first because we've found some problems with it, or no, don't publish it at all. Those are basically your three things. And once that's been sorted, once the editor then sends the decision letter back to the author and then says, yep, you're good to go, or you've got to make some changes, or we're not going to publish this. And if it's the first two, then you make your changes, send it back, and then it gets published. And where it gets published is all important, because as in anything, there are good scientific journals, there are average scientific journals, and there are mediocre scientific journals. And the good scientific journals will be ones that your readers have probably heard of, like sort of Science, Nature, New England Journal of Medicine, those sorts of things that you hear about in the media fairly often when there is a big thing happening. And the good journals are reserved for the truly groundbreaking pieces of science. So, and that should tell you something, really, that if you're piece of science that you've published is not in the best journal out there, then it's not a groundbreaking piece of work. It is merely bog standard, average, or even mediocre, or even wrong. Because sadly, there are journals out there who will publish anything. The reason they will do that is because you have to pay to publish a paper in those particular journals. So we call these predatory journals. And they, sadly, are proliferating at a great rate of knots at the moment. Every day you get an email, or I certainly do, every day I get an email from a new journal saying, come and submit your paper to us. We promise it'll be reviewed and published within a week, which if anybody knows anything about scientific publishing...
That's not a realistic timeline.
all you've got to do is pay us your $400 to this bank account in generally India, and you will have it published. And so the fluoride research that often gets quoted in the literature comes from the low-tier journals. Absolutely it does. And again, if there were a proven link between fluoride and all of these health problems that fluoride anti-proponents, shall we say, claim, then it would surely be published in the New England Journal of Medicine or The Lancet or Science or Nature or those really, really good journals. Now, that's not to say that some rubbish doesn't get published in those journals. It does. Sometimes it slips through, but it's very, very rare. You can basically hang your hat on the results that are in those very, very good journals. Whereas for these lower-level ones, the results are either routine or dubious at best. And so whenever somebody points to the fact that this, you know, that something's been published, that it's in the scientific literature, you've got to take that with a grain of salt. You've got to go and then look up the journal in which it was published and say, right, how good is that journal? And as Michelle Dickinson said on her website, the main way in which the quality of a journal is judged is by a thing called the impact factor of the journal. And that is based on essentially the number of other scientists who read the papers that are published in that journal and quote them in their own work. And so the higher the number of quotes or references or whatever you want to call them, or citations, I guess, is the scientific term. So the higher number of citations that a particular journal gets in a year divided by the number of papers that it publishes in the year constitutes a thing called the impact factor. The higher the impact factor, the better the journal, basically, because the more people are reading it and the more people are recognising that the work published in there is worthy of being cited.
Mm.
So
wasn't also in this case the research that was quoted by the anti-fluoride activist that was taken from a journal in India that looked at a particular context in India with pregnant Indian women?
Yes, yep.
And it was totally inapplicable to the New Zealand context
as
well.
Yes, indeed it was, yeah. And I believe that the situation there was that they had extraordinarily high levels of fluoride in the groundwater anyway, so they had about 4 parts per million, whereas the natural occurring level in New Zealand is about 0.5 ppm, 0.5 ppm. And that's the naturally occurring limit. And what we do is we bump it up to about 0.7 to 1 ppm, which has been shown to give the most effective
have the best effects
on your oral health. Mm. So
and also this is monitored very closely as well.
And you know, one of the other arguments that the anti-fluoride people use is that they use industrial waste as their source of fluoride, which is again a load of nonsense. Fluoride is fluoride is fluoride. It doesn't matter where it comes from. So and the anti-fluoride people do have their own journal, which is just called Fluoride. And where you will find, funnily enough, lots of articles sort of railing against the bad health effects of fluoride. So if you've got a journal that's run by, you know, the anti-fluoride people, chances are
the research is going to be tarnished in that sort of particular way. So staying on the theme of debunking science myths, let's move on to our next topic today. So something you've said on the show several times now is that there is no such thing as alternative medicine. There is only medicine and not medicine.
Yes.
I was wondering if you could flesh this out a little bit more for us.
Hopefully it just sort of stands as it is. I think which should be fairly self-explanatory, really. But the words alternative medicine haven't been around for really very long, maybe sort of, you know, the past 20 or 30 years possibly. And now it's trying to be rebranded as, say, something like complementary medicine or words to that effect. But it's still the same sort of thing. There's medicine that works, and then that's it.
Mm.
Okay? So if it works, it's a medicine. If it doesn't, then it's not. And so we have things like, dare I say it, homeopathy. You'll get phone calls. you know, which is classed perhaps an alternative medicine. But it's not, you know, it doesn't work. Where are the clinical studies that say that it's anything better than the placebo effect, which is the way that any sort of positive results from that can be explained.
Mm.
So, you know, and I guess a lot of people think of alternative medicine as being sort of natural. That's often a word that's bandied around as well, that if something's natural, it's got to be good for you. And so things like, for example, the first plant-derived drug that was marketed was in fact morphine, which was dated from about 1820s or something apparently, and that's derived from the opium, which is derived from the poppy.
Mm.
So you can extract that, and you know that people would call that a natural medicine, which it is. It absolutely is. It's derived from plants, and there are a whole lot of medicines that we use today that are derived from plants. Aspirin is certainly one of them. So that it was known since at least a couple of thousand years ago that boiling up willow bark, and if you drank the extract of that, it would help with fever and stuff like that. And essentially what you have in willow bark is nearly aspirin. It's just differs in one slight respect, but basically that's it. So people found way back when that when they tried this willow bark extract, it was horribly bitter and they couldn't get people to take it, and so they just chemically modified it, put a little group on the molecule, and everything was good. And that's how aspirin came about. So a lot of natural compounds have been used as the basis of drugs, and that's a good thing. But there's also natural compounds out there that will absolutely kill you. Okay, so one of the most toxic things on planet Earth is a thing called paleotoxin. And this was found in one single rock pool in Hawaii. And I think a teaspoon of that would do for the entire population of Auckland. It is that toxic.
Wow.
Yeah. So it's extraordinarily poisonous, but it's natural.
Mm.
So natural doesn't necessarily mean, you know,
does not make it inherently healthy or good for you.
No. So, you know, don't go touting things as being as being good for you because they're natural, because they're not.
Mm.
You know, there's way more to it than that.
Totally.
And that's kind of where the alternative medicine practitioners, again, in my view, come. They're trying to say, right, well, you know, you've got these horrible, you know, man-made, quote-unquote, drugs, you know, and they're bad for you, but we've got all these things in nature, and so therefore they must be good for you. No, they mustn't.
Mm.
Some certainly are. The World Health Organization has got a list of 252 drugs that are considered basic and essential, and of those 252, 11% of them are derived from plants. So we certainly owe a debt to the natural world for some of our drugs. Absolutely we do. For others, we owe a debt to scientists for coming up with these.
Absolutely.
So.
Yeah, and I just think it's very important that reiterate what you mean by this is that fundamentally, like, this is how science works. It's not being narrow-minded. It's that what exists as scientific knowledge is that which is robust research behind it, and that new things and new ways of thinking are added to this body of knowledge all the time.
Yes, absolutely.
But having that fundamental research is what, you know, that's critical criteria there.
That's the basis of science. Yeah, everything is testable in science, and if it doesn't pass the test, if it doesn't work, then you discard it and you go on.
Mm.
So if something is proven to be false, if something is proven to be harmful, then, you know, by all means, get rid of it. That's the way that science advances. The fact that, yes, science can be wrong, or, you know, people's work can be wrong, and it can be shown as such. It can be shown to be wrong. And things that we think are right today might be shown, you know, 100, 200 years down the track to be wrong. And sadly, that's what gives the alternative medicine people hope.
Right, yeah.
Because they'll be saying, oh, well, you know, we don't think it's true today, but, you know, give us a couple of hundred years and, you know, we'll show you. But
it's like, well, you can do that with research, and then
it
becomes medicine, or it becomes scientific knowledge, and that's fundamentally how this thing operates. Yeah.
Okay. No, agreed.
And so our last topic today, talk to us about a new controversial TV show that has been criticised for glorifying suicide. Talk to us about this.
Well, this would be the first time I've ever talked about mental health, I would say, on on the radio. And so the series 13 Reasons Why, so this came out on Netflix a couple of weeks ago, and my partner thought, oh, this looks really good, it's all over Facebook, let's watch it. And so once we started, we couldn't stop and binge watched the whole thing in 2 days. So to cut a long story short, it is, as you say, the story of a high school student's suicide. Not to give too much away, what she does is she leaves 13 cassette tapes behind, each of which is basically dedicated to one person, and which outlines the things that that person did, basically, that drove her to the edge and made her take her own life. Now, I was listening to national radio this morning. I'm allowed to say that on this station, aren't I?
Of course.
Sure, no, it might be blasphemy.
Where... the Mental Health Foundation representative was on saying that it was glorifying suicide, and he didn't think that it should have been shown, and I was quite astonished by that. I think the last thing that this program does is glorify suicide. I thought it was an absolutely gripping, dramatic, very, very, very realistic depiction of just how horrible people can be to each other, and the depth that people can sink to, I guess, as a result of those terrible acts. And some of it was very, very, very difficult to watch. Mm. Extraordinarily difficult to watch. The actual suicide itself was, it was tear-inducing. It really was not a glorification of it at all. So, and again, on National Radio this morning, they had a high school student interviewed as well who basically saying that this sort of stuff is not discussed in schools, and it should be. And
right.
The fact that this has been shown has now led to some sort of debate, and surely that can only be a good thing.
Mm.
If people are feeling like this, then maybe, I don't know, the fact that here's a depiction of that other people feel the same way, you know, maybe that makes things easier, I don't know, but it's surely not a sort of thing that shouldn't be discussed.
Right, so you're saying that the proposal that this should be censored and shouldn't have been launched in the first place isn't the right sort of way to receive this program?
No, I don't think so at all. I think it's it's a compelling TV program. I think it's absolutely brilliantly done.
Mm.
And I would urge everybody out there maybe to watch it and make up your own minds.
Mm. Full disclosure, I haven't seen the series myself, so I can't speak about my own opinions of it, but I have read several critiques about the show and how it tackles suicide.
Yeah.
One of them said that it tackled it in a sensationalist and reductive way because it depicts the main character, Hannah, her suicide, as a way to expose the actions of her peers and makes them feel guilty rather than actually trying to explore the nuances of mental illness. I think that there's a line from the article that said that it attempts to take on suicide without even mentioning the word depression. I just wanted to know your thoughts about that.
Possibly, yes. I can't remember the word depression being mentioned. Then again, how many suicidal people mention that word anyway? Possibly, you know.
Aren't able to seek that particular help and recognise it for what it is before.
Yeah. But again, it is one of those things where people will have to make up their own minds. But all of this publicity that it has garnered, it's going to ensure that people
talk about it,
and I think that's the most important thing. Having said that, I'm not sure that it's a show that's really aimed at teenagers. Possibly, it seemed to me to be sort of aimed at a more mature audience. Maybe that's just my feeling. I'm a more mature audience, I guess, and I found it riveting. So maybe young people do as well, but it needs to be watched. It really, really does.
Absolutely.
So
great. Well, thank you for joining us again this week, Alan. For I think it's a responsibility to say for anybody listening, and you might have any of those thoughts yourself, Lifeline New Zealand, the number to call is 0800 543 354. I think it's a really important thing to be aware of, that it's important to recognise these things and to talk about them.
And talk to people. Absolutely. Yeah. Talk to people.
Great.
That was Dear Science.
One in 20 New Zealanders use cannabis medicinally. Most of them are committing a crime because existing access criteria are too strict, the process too slow, and the products too expensive. If you think a health issue shouldn't be a crime, join the Medical Cannabis Rally and March this Saturday, starting at 1 p.m. in Aotea Square. March down Queen Street and show your support for law reform in New Zealand. The Medical Cannabis Rally and March, this Saturday, 22nd of April. Rally at high noon, march at 1 p.m. Presented by the Auckland Patient Groups and Normal, with support from the Hemp Store.
What do you think of Sigrid's 1-4?
Good music. I don't know. It's good.
Cigarette? No thanks. I don't smoke.
Nah, I gave up a few years ago.
I think she's friends with Emily Adrosa. That's very cool.
Great radio voice, cool music. What's not to like?
Oh, yeah, I got a lighter if you need one.
Yeah, I'd love one, actually. Taylee?
124? I mean, I suppose I could make one last that long. Just take real little puffs, I guess.
Sigrid! It's Sigrid. S-I-G-R-I-D. Fuck's sake.
The Thursday 1-4 with Sigrid, right here on BFM, keeping you bopping along with all the best deep cuts and bouncy wee numbers from Aotearoa and beyond.
Sigrid!
Their relationships with their girlfriends or their wife. No one, they shouldn't have more than one wife at a time.
Yes, we're tuned into 95BFM. Next up, a new report reviewing Kiwis' experiences with mental health services is set to be launched later this afternoon. The report summarises key themes raised in more than 500 stories submitted to the People's Mental Health Review and also contains four key recommendations based on these themes. Earlier today, I spoke to report author and Action Station spokesperson, Marianne Elliott, for a preview about the findings and started by asking her to explain the context around the report and why it was launched in the first place.
So this came out at the Action Station side of things. This came out of an announcement in February last year that the government was cutting funding to mental health right across the country. We responded with a very focused campaign looking at the need to reverse those cuts, specifically in Canterbury. And there was some success on that. There was an additional $20 million put back into mental health funding in Canterbury. But when we had that success, the response we got from all around the country was people saying, look, we've got the same problems here. We've got, you know, in Auckland, in Dunedin, in Hamilton. So we realised that, you know, there was a much bigger campaign needed. And then we were approached by a psychotherapist, Kyle McDonald, and Mike King, the comedian, has done a lot of advocacy around mental health, saying, look, we've been asking for a government inquiry into this for a long time. They won't do it. What about if Action Station took this on and did it as a people's review? And we thought that was a great response to the government's refusal to act, so we did it.
And so now the report is complete, can you talk me some of the key themes that you found?
Yeah, so one of the things that struck me, because I did the analysis for this report, so I read 500 stories. And one thing that struck me reading those stories was that there were a lot of people who were experiencing mental distress, whether it was anxiety or depression or, you know, a whole range of other kinds of mental distress. And they were doing what we've been told to do. You know, for years we've been told, don't keep it to yourself, don't struggle alone, you know, ask for help, talk to your GP, you know, reach out to mental health services. So they were doing that, but what they were being told was that they basically weren't sick enough. They weren't sick enough to qualify for publicly funded mental health services. So they had two options. One was to sort of struggle along without any help, or the other was to privately fund their own care. And obviously for a lot of people in New Zealand, that's just not an option. So that inability to access help when people needed it, and effectively feeling that they couldn't get the help they needed until they were in a real crisis was one of the big things that came through.
And so now you have an idea about some of the major issues with the system. What are the next steps?
So we will be, alongside the launch of the report today, we're going to be launching an open letter that will have four key recommendations in it. And we're going to be asking Action Station community members to sign on to that open letter, but we're also going to be inviting organisations. So a lot of the stories that came into our review came from people working in the mental health system, not just people trying to use or access those services. So we're hoping that some of those organisations representing mental health workers, the unions, the nurses' organisations, will sign on in support of this. And we're going to just really try to keep this story through the open letter and getting organisations to sign on to it and getting hopefully, you know, tens of thousands of New Zealanders to support it. Keep this issue front and centre for all political parties as we go into the election this year.
And so you think you're trying to make this an election issue then?
Yeah, well, I would say it's already an election issue. I did see a comment from Andrew Little that as he's gone around the country, issues around mental health and the inability to access mental health services has been coming up for him in all of those public meetings. So I think it's already an issue. It's going to be an issue this election. I think if you haven't personally had an experience of needing support from mental health services, you almost certainly know and love somebody who has. So this is an issue that all New Zealanders care about. We're just giving that sort of sense of large-scale public concern some focus and an action that people can take so that they can then take those recommendations if they're going to a candidate meeting where they're going to, you know, see people who might be asking for their vote, or if there's, you know, public meetings in the lead up to the election. It's an opportunity for people to have something really focused that they can take in and say, hey, will you commit to this? This is what our mental health system needs. Will you commit to it?
Absolutely. I mean, I don't know, I'm with experiences that I've had myself, I just find it so jarring how there are such limited specific circumstances that people need to be in to get any sort of public assistance for any of the support that exists in New Zealand. It's just really quite shocking to me.
It is, and it's distressing for the people who work in the system as well, and that's the thing that emerged in our report. People, you know, described going home at the end of the day's work as either a mental health nurse or a mental health professional, saying, I go home at the end of the day dissatisfied and distressed at the people who I've had to turn away who needed our help. And, you know, that's a really alarming story to sort of read, you know, story after story after story from people who are seeing that from the, you know, from the workforce side as well.
Like, naked is the theme. Like, people just love getting naked.
That was Action Station spokesperson Marianne Elliott speaking about the People's Mental Health Review. We'd just like to respond to a text message. Keep in mind that not all suicide is the result of depression. There are several other mental illnesses where people have had suicidal ideations, or act upon it, I should mean. Yes, we definitely agree with this. Depression is definitely not one of the only causes for suicide. Coming up, the march this Saturday, scientists across the globe are marching in unison. Their aim, to celebrate science as a pillar of human freedom and prosperity, while fighting back against a growing agenda in politics, which aims to spread misinformation and anti-science views. I spoke with March for Science New Zealand spokesperson Dr. Cindy Hall about what exactly the movement is and the reasons behind its inception.
Not necessarily primarily a protest. It's more of a celebration of science. We have a lot to celebrate throughout New Zealand in terms of science. There are amazing things happening in all realms of scientific and critical thinking and research throughout New Zealand. So first and foremost, we like to see it as a celebration of science.
I've heard that it's an anti-Trump stance that's been taken this Saturday.
Well, certainly the global march for science evolved out of things that are happening in the U.S. politically that impact on science and that reject a lot of things, that a lot of knowledge and results that have come out of the scientific process. So certainly the basis for all of the events all over the world, not just in New Zealand, is in response to the Trump administration's actions in the U.S. My perspective and that of our group is that politics and science are geopolitical, first and foremost. So what impacts scientists and people in the United States impacts the entire world. New Zealand is marching, A, to celebrate science, because we have a lot to celebrate, like I said, also in acknowledgement and in support of our colleagues and other global citizens in the United States and the rest of the world, all of whom are going to be affected by and already are being affected by some of the challenges to science that are happening right now.
What kind of challenges are you speaking of? Would you be able to give us an example?
Well, there are lots of threats to science. Certainly some of the things that we know of and well-publicized ones in the U.S. are dismantling of certain agencies that have a really solid base in science, such as the Environmental Protection Agency in the United States. Climate change denial is another really huge one. Scientists have known about climate change since the 1960s. This is not an alternative fact. This is a reality that a number of people, by political rhetoric, have been encouraged to believe this phenomenon doesn't exist. It does. And the denial of it and the defunding of research to do something about it is going to necessarily impact the world.
Are there specific goals which the March for Science is trying to achieve?
Well, certainly what I alluded to before, which is, a celebration, to have a forum where scientists and other scholarly researchers and the public and the community can get together and find out a little bit more about each other's concerns, where people can get some hands-on interaction with scientists and what scientists do and how that contributes, how what they do contributes to the community and society at large. It's also a great opportunity for scientists to get out of their labs and get out in front of the public and show off the great stuff that they do.
You touch upon how science is now almost a political stance. Why is it now an important thing that this be known when historically the sciences have been adamant in their political neutrality?
Certainly the scientific method is based in neutrality. So I think it's important to distinguish between scientists as individuals and the scientific method that they do. So what we do is we approach things, we gather data, we test hypotheses, we try to figure out what's going on in whatever area that we're studying, and then come to some conclusions based on the data. That's the process. Scientists haven't necessarily, I don't think, always been non-political as people. There are numerous examples of researchers and practitioners in my field, certainly, which is clinical psychology, who have stepped up to inform and appeal to elected officials. I'm a member of the American Psychological Association for example, and it has always had an advocacy and lobbying kind of arm of its organization, and has had members go and speak to Congress about women's health, the effects of child abuse, and this is things have been going on for decades. So again, I wouldn't say that this is a new thing, that scientists are being political. I think that by nature, we tend to be really methodical folks who stick to what we do and want to kind of just be able to present the facts. That doesn't mean that those facts in their presentation cannot have and don't and shouldn't have a place in political realms.
Have you seen anti-science positions becoming a more commonplace thing in politics recently?
I think that we see it more. I'm not sure if they're actually more common, but I think that people, again, because of the interconnectivity of the world, we are aware of those kinds of sentiments. I also think that certainly most recent election cycle in the U.S. and the current administration have utilized anti-science attitudes to tap into certain constituents, and then has, I think, manipulated information and continues to keep people misinformed or manage their attitudes in a way that fits with the goals of the administration. That's a purely psychological phenomenon, which lots of psychologists are studying and have studied.
For those who are interested in participating in this march, how are they able to join?
Well, anybody and everyone is welcome. That's the first important part. There are different kinds of events happening in most of the main centers in New Zealand. As I understand, and first of all, just to say, there's a Facebook page, March for Science New Zealand, which has all of the information and the updated event information. So I don't have a lot of details about many of the events except for Dunedin, but certainly people can just come along and listen to the speakers. Some of them are marches, some of them are rallies. Ours in Dunedin is just a rally. We're not going to be marching down the streets. We're just going to be organizing in one spot and then having some speakers and music and science demonstrations and all kinds of fun stuff. So it's not a matter of you have to have a sign, you have to march, you have to feel or believe a certain way. This is, again, a celebration and a community gathering that we're just hoping that people will come along, have some fun, and learn a bit about science and critical thinking.
That was The Wire.
Yes, that was March for Science New Zealand spokesperson Dr. Cindy Hall talking about the upcoming global event, the March for Science. If you are interested in attending the Auckland rally, it is being held this Saturday and it is starting at Queen Elizabeth II Square at 1:30 p.m. For more information, look up March for Science New Zealand's Facebook page. That marks the end of another Wednesday show. Thank you, Shamina, for hosting the first half of the show. She's unfortunately had to go off and attend something. Thanks to those who spoke with us. We had C. Payne, Stephen Hoadley, Alan Blackman, Marianne Elliott, and Cindy Hall. Also, thank you all for tuning in. We'll be back next week. Stay tuned with the Wonderful with Bridge coming up next.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.